coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody. Happy Tuesday night. Hope everything is going well for all of you right now. We've got a great night lined up tonight. We've got a great night lined up next week. Next week is a full pre-record show. As many of you know, whenever I go on the road for work, I always give you a fully pre-recorded show. Typically, our live show consists of a live guest, then a pre-recorded guest. That way, if we go long with the live guest, the other one isn't waiting. But whenever I'm gone, it's all pre-recorded, but it's still new content. So it's never like I've taken two episodes and spliced them together or given you a greatest hits or something like that. It's always new content here. And next week, we will be talking with Terry Lynn Kell, who is the executive director of the newly reformed International UFO Bureau that was originally formed in 1957 by Hayden Hughes in Oklahoma City. And it has been reformed. We're going to be talking about that, the mission of the IUFOB. And then we're going to talk with Ryan Edwards, our cryptozoologist friend, about Gugwe and Gugwe research, how it relates to Bigfoot, things like that. And tonight, in our second part of the episode, we're going to have Mike Turber on. And as always, whenever we have a pre-recorded guest, sometimes there's updates. We're going to be talking about the drone situation in New Jersey and specifically the White House response to the drone situation and what that means. In addition, the horrible plane crash, and really talking about both of these in terms of sensational news, you know, and what that can do to investigations, what hearsay and conjecture can do. So we're going to be talking with that about that with Mike Turber. And there were some updates today, like they just found the info from all the black boxes and realized that the instrumentation was apparently wrong on heights. So there's an update to part of our episode later tonight. In our first part, we are pleased to welcome back our good friend James Keenan. He is most well known for his work on Mystery at Blind Frog Ranch. He is a researcher of ancient civilizations. He's also an author. We've had him on numerous times talking about his work in the world of fiction and the paranormal. He's got a fantastic YouTube channel out there, James Keenan and, James Keenan Giants and Paranormal is the name of his YouTube channel. Sorry about that, folks. New glasses. But welcome back to the show. James Keenan, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Christopher. How are you?
Doing fantastic. And, the researching ancient civilizations, that is a fascinating path that you have gone down since the time that we first had you on the show. And like we were saying pre-show, the fact that you are now getting to focus your efforts on your research, it's been interesting over the last few episodes that we've had you on to see literally the windfall of things that have fallen into your lap, and not even fallen into your lap, but come to you through good, hard work. And it's phenomenal and led to you being a mainstay part of Mystery at Blind Frog Ranch and really leading them down some fantastic roads of discovery there on the property.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, no, the ancient cultures, ancient civilizations, a large part of that is the supernatural portion, the aspects of those cultures and civilizations. Probably the thing that I'm focused in the most are the giants, these people of great stature in the past that were the living deities of, our ancestors. So, and we more than likely at some point were, descendants of some of them that ended up having to mate with Homo sapien at one point.
Yeah. And quite literally, those stories, especially here in the American Southwest, center right there in the Uintah Basin. Like, those are prominently featured in the local lore and culture. Things like Lovelock Cave, that kind of stuff. So,
absolutely. You have the Site Ka, which are one of the four groups or tribes of these people of great stature that were in the Americas that we're aware of. And a lot of people would know them as the redheaded cannibal giants, which is somewhat right. They were probably more redheaded headhunters.
Yeah. Well, and even then, the stories were horrifying, you know, stories of people being chased and thrown into baskets with spikes and all right. kinds of stuff to the point that, you know, they, according to stories, drove them into a cave, blocked them off with a bunch of wood, and then set the place on fire.
Correct. Up at Lovelock.
Fascinating stuff. And once again, the stories of, and it's interesting, we say stories because to us, they're stories. To Native Americans, they are tradition. They aren't stories. They are something that actively and historically happened.
Correct. When you're discussing that too, the Paiute that are one of those tribes in the desert Southwest, very much so in Nevada. And when you're talking about Lovelock Cave, you're talking about northern Nevada. They state that the Site Ka didn't die off until the 1860s. So it wasn't that far in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And once again, these traditions go back a long way and interweave with other traditions locally. And a lot of your work is in not only studying those traditions, but kind of finding out how they came to be woven together.
Correct. Right. And you know, the best evidence that we have are in some of the artifacts that remain. Definitely the petroglyphs and pictographs. We see a lot of these anthropomorphic figures, human-like figures that have six fingers, super large feet. There's one there outside of Vernal, Utah, that they actually named the giant. And it is a headhunter. It's ripped off somebody's head. You can see the spine attached to it still in the rock art. And with the Shoshone and the Paiute that were in that area, even before the Ute tribe, the stories of these people of great stature are interwoven into their own history and their past.
Yeah, precisely. And how did researching these take you down the path of Aztec tradition?
So when you look at what is remaining of the Amatls, which are the codices for the Aztec, their history states that they came from the north. And we can actually track the migratory routes and the migrations back and forth of these people, you know, all the way to the ancient Puebloans, and then whoever, maybe the Fremont that lived in, you know, northeastern Utah, could very well have been a part of what we then later have come to know as the Aztec. Their real name are the Kulwa Mexica, which were one of many groups of these Mexica people, the Aztec that we know them as. So we also know that from a lot of the oral traditions that they believe that they originated quite possibly from Aslan, which may very well be around Salt Lake, the Great Salt Lake. And that's after what they believe all Native Americans originated from, Tamuanchan, which they may have renamed in their culture and history as Chicomostoc or the Seven Caves.
And that's what kind of brings us up to date with what's happening this season on Blind Frog Ranch, not to not to, you know, say that in such a quintessential way, but in all actuality, that is up to speed with what's happening. And the information that you have found, the codices that you've found, the maps that you've found, and specifically the images, I've got the images up on screen right here of the seven caves. Let's start breaking this down a little bit, James. And what does this mean? What does the imagery mean? And what does it mean for the research going on the ranch right now?
Sure. So what everybody needs to know and understand is that all the history of the Aztec has actually been borrowed from them and taken from even older cultures, specifically the Toltec, who the Aztec actually had to pay tribute to prior to them coming into power. So we're talking about much, much, much further back into distant history than just 500-600 years of the Aztec history. And when we talk about Chicomos Talk, they believe that this is one of those locations where they came up out of the ground after a major cataclysmic event. It was the end of the fourth world, eventually the beginning of the fifth world that we're now in, according to a lot of Native American cultures. And when you're talking about mystery at Blind Frog Ranch, you know, we're looking for the Aztec treasure. Well, where else, what would be the best place to hide something if they were trying to keep it from the Spaniards after they were able to remove it after the Night of Sorrows, but to take it back home to Tamuan Chan, or what, again, could very well have been renamed Chicomos Talk by the Kulwa Mexica, who are the Aztec as we know them from Tenochtitlan, which now is Mexico City.
And even the technology used to build Teotihuacan was pretty incredible. You know, whenever you start looking at things like even right now, current Mexico City, which lies partially on the ruins, is sinking in many parts because of the water.
Right.
The whole place was flooded. It was a purposefully flooded area. And it's fascinating to see the ways in which they controlled water to make that happen.
Oh yeah. Their aqueduct systems would bring water from miles away, fresh water through this dirty water in Lake Texcoco. And, what they more than likely did was they borrowed that technology from even older cultures. That's why, we actually went to Teotihuacan, which is not an Aztec location. We're not quite sure who the originators of that city were, but the aqueduct systems and all that are very similar to what the Aztec used. They probably learned that from the Toltec as well. And then, you know, the Toltec probably learned that from the descendants of what we know as the Olmec. So everything's interrelated, interlaced. And it just becomes interesting because we see a few similarities occurring in the Uinta Mountain area at different locations, not just at Blind Frog Ranch, but at other sites as well that are probably a lot older than just 500 or 600 years. So it obviously wasn't the Spaniards when they came in to mine for gold and silver and copper.
Yeah, or even, you know, what would be considered modern day miners, you know, gold rush time, things like that, and beyond. And what are some of these telltale signatures that you're talking about? Because of course, you know, it could be that it's a local indigenous Indian population that did it, something like that. Could be somebody before them that was still local. What are the telltale signatures that you're talking about that really point to these structures and the other data being
sure.
Aztec?
So it couldn't have been any of the more recent cultures like the Shoshone, the Paiute, or the Ute, because you don't see it in any of their local tradition, but you do see it in the ancient Puebloan the Hisatsunan, we used to call them Anasazi. So you see these similarities, but you see these, what almost appears to be like diversion systems at certain locations where the water changes pressure underground. Mm-hmm. And it would be, I mean, it is possible that it could be natural.
Sure.
You know, I don't ever want to rule that out. It could be going from a larger river into smaller sinkholes or other subaqueous voids. So that's possible. However, with the magnetometer, we've located these. It could also be natural fissures, but it almost seems like they were man-made. They almost seem too straight. So they seem to appear to be more like breathing holes, these airflow systems that lead 120 feet plus underground. So it's really interesting because nature doesn't usually make anything perfectly straight. And the one from last season was, I believe, 122 or 124 feet, and it was almost completely straight. It was just an amazing find.
Yeah.
With the magnetometer. It was just incredible. Now, unfortunately, the powers that be decided to use demolition explosives on it. I wasn't too excited about doing that first. You know, I would have liked to have tried other ways of accessing that fissure or that unnatural man-made hole, if that was what it was. But unfortunately, now the whole area was flooded because of the tremendous amount of snow that occurred in 2023.
Yep. Yeah. And to see that and to see once again, and don't get me wrong, there are straight fissures in nature, things like that. But when you're talking about one on a fault line, the way that the fault line runs through Blind Frog Ranch, you'd be hard pressed to find one like that.
Right.
You know, I mean, typically the example that I give is, I can't find it right now, but I have I thought I had it. I have a pyrite cube that I normally keep, and it's literally just a natural cube of pyrite, and it's a perfect cube, you know, same as a die. And it's fascinating to know that that happens. And when you're talking about mineral deposits, that kind of stuff, there are fascinating mineral deposits all over the place on the property and the surrounding area.
Absolutely. And what was really more exciting was the fact that we have found several Spanish coins that were from the late 1700s into the very early 1800s, prior to it becoming Mexico. So I mean, they were in horrible condition because of how long they'd been underground. So it's really difficult to tell the exact dates on one or two of them. But just, you know, the fact that it was found at deeper than 10 inches puts it right at about that correct time period. Mm. You know, and unfortunately, at some areas like the bead site, the way that the wind comes in can cover the entire area in a foot within a few weeks. So it's hard to tell what those natural layers are and what the virgin layer is at the site location, just due to the fact the way the wind blows right up into that part, it gets caught in between three hillsides.
Yeah. Yeah. And specifically the bead site there is pretty fascinating. That's where y'all have the smoke chimneys and stuff like that. And y'all actively threw an endoscope down and found some pretty interesting artifacts down there and came across, once things started getting dug out, some fascinating finds.
Right. And I've taken a lot of slack from people online. You know, they're like, if this was a real site, anthropologists should be called in, archaeologists to do their thing. But what people don't recognize is each episode is only 42 minutes. I've been there for years.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like it was done on that 42-minute episode.
That's right.
You know, we've pulled back using an excavator after we did we dug in certain locations, you know, and we stuck to trying to make sure that the provenience and the provenance was done correctly. So you're just seeing a quick snapshot of what's been done over a 6-year period.
Absolutely. And you know, it's funny, James, because I belong to the Acorn communities. I belong to the Skinwalker Ranch communities. And it's always fascinating to me to be a fly on the wall and to see the conversations like, oh, they're never going to find that gold. And it's like, you know, I think the gold is the science that they found along the way and the history changing science that they found along the way, you know, wood, things like that, that they've dug up. And even at Skinwalker Ranch, you know, it's like, oh, they're just going to launch another rocket. It's like, you mean they're just going to do the repeatable science that gives them a result? Like, that's science. I know it may not be sexy to you, but welcome to science. And even this property is the same way. You know, there have been quite a few discoveries along the way from ore and iridium to, you know, the coins to even right now, the concept of there possibly being an aqueduct on the property.
Sure. Another thing that didn't make the show because it was done before my coming on to the season 3 of the show was my soil samples that I took came back as 66 parts per million iridium, which is insane because we know we have 4 known meteorites that have been taken into care, custody, and control in Utah. And from the best one, it was only 52 parts per million. So for the ranch to have 66 parts per million iridium up against the back end of the energy zone is insane. Yeah. I mean, and that was from a top layer, you know, so we may be talking about something that impacted hundreds of millions of years ago.
Yep.
And could have caused the fissures and the faults, you know, just like out in a big crater up north in Arizona. There's all these underground cavern systems all around the crater in Arizona. Same thing may very well have happened in the Uinta Mountains hundreds of millions of years ago. Or maybe it was even more recent, just a few million years ago.
Well, and that being said, there is an interesting geological point, and that's the fact that there isn't a lot of native limestone. Like, I'm here in Austin, Texas. We got nothing but limestone. We got limestone as far as the eye can see. So we have caves, we have aquifers, we have all kinds of stuff. But there are not a lot of natural limestone caves in the area. Most of the caves that are there were made through mining efforts. Stuff
sure,
like
well,
that.
We're talking deeper. We start hitting the limestone. If you go down these huge sinkholes like Mosby Sink or Pole Creek Sink, where the miners actually were creating a lot of mines right down in the sinks, because imagine all this gold coming down off the mountains. Where's it going to go? It's going to go into those sinkholes. And then I'm pretty sure there's a very large, deep underground river system running all the way down into Vernal. Just from the data that's being collected. So imagine what's built up, you know, in these underground lakes, these sumps that are throughout the whole area. Unfortunately, most of them fall on the reservations, and you just don't have access unless you can access it from BLM or forestry, and somehow they're still connected, which we've been having issues with connectivity. Obviously, over time, things collapse, reroute.
Well, and when it comes to the anomalies on the property, you know, when you start talking about one of the things that was gone into this time around, which I was very, very happy about, was the folding of the earth that happens whenever a meteor strikes. I'm a massive rocks and minerals freak, and you know that is one of those things. It's like fulgurites, where it's like if you could find a piece for your collection, it's awesome. But it's literally where the heating of the rock happens, and it only occurs at like nuclear sites or, you know, sites of great impact, because at that point the magnetization and polarization of the magnetite inside of the earth and the rock changes. And points to a different magnetic north than the surrounding rock. And you can really get some cool data at that point. And when you're talking about not only magnetic anomaly like that in the area, but the amount of iridium that you're talking about, malachite and copper all over the place. Water running through copper pipes carries a charge.
Sure, so, especially the water is moderately saline, super high in magnesium,
yeah,
which, you know,
highly mineralized.
You're seeing a lot of this transient electromagnetic energy. It may very well be traveling through this highly positively charged water, you know,
yeah,
positive ions.
Being magnified
by possibility,
magnified by copper deposit and iridium deposit,
sure,
things like
that. It's water traveling through a battery.
Absolutely. So it's interesting when you start looking at the geologic anomalies on the location like that and start bringing those points together. Now, these were things that, of course, would have also made the area, pretty much sacred to the local population.
Yep, and that's why we see such a rich history going way back into the distant past in this location. And if we really are talking about an origin, not just for a few Native American groups and tribes, but for probably most of them, because they had to go somewhere after a major catastrophic event occurred to survive, and that would have had to have been underground. And you see a lot with the Zuni and the Hopi about these ant people supposedly having taken them underground to have survived for who knows how long and then bringing them up. Maybe they're very well, there's something to that, and we just have lost it in the known history. And unfortunately for us, very few artifacts remain. The rock art survives, but anything that would have been made from wood wouldn't survive unless it fell into some type of peat bog.
Yeah, precisely. Or much like the section over in the first cave that was explored, where it's been underwater and been removed from an oxygenated environment. So at that point, it's been preserved, you know.
Right.
And there's a whole pile of hand-hewn timbers that they got data from this year, but they didn't go back that far, as far as dating.
Correct.
Like
it was
that.
More recent, unfortunately. Yeah. So not what we were looking for. But you know what? It could be when you think about maybe somebody else was looking for exactly what we are currently looking for.
Exactly. Precisely. And you know, the question, of course, comes in, like, how the heck were those huge logs brought in? Now, they're still trying to uncover many things. And unfortunately, you know, there were other issues, stuff like that. I don't want to give away a lot of the season, you know, and have a bunch of spoilers in the episode. But
I don't want to do that either, because I'll get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, same. but when you're talking about research, like, once again, researching the technology used by ancient Aztecs to build their cities, things like that. What else other than the aquifer or the aqueducts would be a telltale sign of their civilization, as opposed to, let's say, the Pueblo civilization there locally, or, you know, the Anasazi, things like that?
So there are several petroglyphs in the area that don't make sense with any of the local Native American tribes or cultures. But boy, they sure as hell fit in perfectly with the Mexica, the Aztec. They match identical what the Aztec would have had as their special forces, the costumes that they wore in battle, the weaponry being used. And then one specific petroglyph at McConkey Ranch, which is Dry Fork Canyon petroglyphs. All the research I've been doing over the last 3 years in Mexico City and in Sevilla, Spain, 95% of it looks to be Moctezuma's brother, who became the 10th Tlatoani emperor of the Aztec after he was killed, named Cuitlahuac. It looks like he faked his death, took his warriors, took everything that was dredged out of Texcoco that was dropped by the Spaniards, took the additional hidden treasure from Cortez, and then marched it all northward. And we have some groups of those desert Southwest Native Americans that say they saw these huge groups of warriors going northward. So we have this oral tradition and we have these certain petroglyphs that sure as heck seem to match 95% with the Aztec. And
fascinating.
There's some additional pieces of the history that I can't talk about yet.
Sure.
But like I said, stay tuned. You know, the next 8 episodes will be coming out very soon. They've already been filmed. I don't want to give too much away with one or two of those little puzzle pieces yet.
And you know, here's the thing, folks. Whenever you're talking about researching things like Mayan culture, Aztec culture, stuff like that, you have to remember that this was a conquered culture. It's not like studying Roman culture or something like that, where, you know, eventually they fell. These cultures, most of what they had was destroyed. Most of what they had was considered anathema by the church that was following in tow with the conquistadors, things like that. So most of the codices, it's not like they took the care to translate them into Spanish and then burned them. They just burned them.
Well, here's what a lot of people don't know is actually in 1433, the emperor of the Aztec wanted to make the Aztec feel like they were special, that they were from gods. So he destroyed much of their books and history so that they wouldn't know they were a roaming tribe from the north. And then what a lot of people don't understand is all the tribes in Mesoamerica, probably about 85-90% of them, hated the Aztec.
Yeah.
Because most of them were sacrificing their children, their women, their warriors.
Yeah.
And they were more than happy to join forces with Cortez to defeat Moctezuma and the Triple Alliance Aztec. It was brutal. At the end, while they were fighting with Cortez, Moctezuma was the city of Tenochtitlan was sacrificing 200 to 500 people per day in attempts to defeat the Spaniards by calling upon their gods to defeat Cortez. And the only way was it was a blood sacrifice.
Yeah.
And it was way worse. They didn't just rip their hearts out. They would take these little children. They would take their legs and arms off while they were watching and eat them while they were watching.
Wow.
As they were crying, it made an even better sacrifice to the gods. And then they would cut open their chest, take their heart out, burn it so that the essence would go to the gods. So, I mean, it was brutal.
Yeah.
And they were more than happy to follow the Spaniards instead of the Aztec Empire.
And, you know, once again, the idea that one of the Aztec rulers was responsible for a lot of the destruction, it's very interesting because when you look at other cultures, specifically the Egyptian culture comes to mind. Greek culture was the same way. When people were conquered or when a new dynasty came in, it was not uncommon to chip off the face of somebody or repaint the face to be yours.
Sure.
That's exactly what happened with Egypt whenever they became sun god centric, you know, things like that. So it's not an old story or a new story, rather, amongst old civilizations to change the histories, so to speak, to fit a paradigm. Now, getting back to that history, specifically the Seven Caves, let's break this image apart a little bit. From the Codex of the Seven Caves here.
Sure. So what you're looking at is they always discuss the caves being under this tilted or bent mountain or hillside. And we have something very similar to that on the ranch. And then you obviously see the Desert Southwest. It's also northern Mexico cactus that we see. Yeah. And then you see this individual that's wearing the coyote or the wolf skin and is sending up the fire and smoke. So we talked, there's a lot of possibilities. I personally don't think it has anything to do with the skinwalker or a shapeshifter.
No.
I do believe it has to do with their medicine men and their ritualistic beliefs. But inside the cave, what it is showing is that it was seven different groups that were attempting to come together and create one empire at some point. So, you know, it's a representation, and people have to understand that it's being represented in a book. So the caves could have been miles apart from each other, and these groups were miles apart, but it was more of a coming together, them speaking, them surviving underground, and this being origin. I always try to make that the biggest point, that we're looking at an origin, not just for the Aztec, but more than likely for all Native Americans of the Americas, you know, so.
Well, and you know, there was something that specifically struck me about the image, James. Not only the man dressed in the wolfskin, as you said, more than likely a medicine man, but specifically the shape of the seven caves. And when you look at, once again, the cactuses up top, like you said, cactuses of the Southwest, the caves themselves are another cactus of the Southwest, the peyote cactus.
Yep.
And like right here, specifically, you can see the buttons of the cactus, everything else. So the idea of also even these seven tribes that lived in seven caves that perhaps got together in these spots for ritualistic use.
When you look closely at the larger original maps of the CODIS, the Amatl, there are models for the Aztec. It's actually water features surrounding some points of it. So now we're talking about these underground rivers that even like in Turkey, you know, at Derinkuyu and places like that, they were there because there's a river at the bottom. So they were able to survive underground because there was water source. And we see that in Mesoamerica, we see that in the desert Southwest, and we especially see it in the Uinta Mountains.
Well, and once again, especially on this property where it seems as though there is what looks like an artificial aquifer on the property.
Possibly, right.
Now, what are some of the things that point to that? Because once again, the fact that there's head pressure is fascinating, because even if you have a void here and it's surface pressure here and the two are connected, you know, you'll get some, but not an explosive amount of pressure, not a head pressure amount of pressure.
Right. There's a couple things that I can't discuss.
I know.
Again, stay tuned is the best thing I can tell you to, you know, that goes along with exactly what we're talking about right now.
Sure, sure. And, you know, other technologies, other things that pointed to the fact that it might be Aztec. What about the building materials, stuff like that?
The concrete was very interesting to find concrete because it was used throughout Mesoamerica, and we're finding it at these levels that are putting it probably right back around 500 years ago, which would fit perfectly into when we believe that they brought the treasure and historical artifacts back north, led by Cuitlahuac, who was Moctezuma's brother.
Now, what do we have as far as histories for is there anything in the codices as far as where this gold may have ended up?
No. So what happened was on the night of sorrows, I believe it was June 30 of 1520, the Aztec kicked out Cortez and his men out of Tenochtitlan, and the Spaniards were so greedy. Each man was holding about 80 plus pounds of gold underneath his armor, and they didn't want to let it go. So when they were knocked off the causeways into the water, they drowned.
Oh, well, wow.
So then obviously the Aztec dredged the water, got that back. They were hiding a lot more of the gold, because Cortez really only took possession of Moctezuma's father's gold that was in the palace that Cortez and his men were staying in. It was hidden behind a wall that had been sealed, a doorway that was sealed, which they found. So there was a ton of treasure because they were still trying to pay off to get allies when Cortez came back. So we know that they were loaded still with treasure, and it was taken northward. And we see a lot of these special forces, I like to call them,
okay.
You know, like the jaguar warriors, sure. And these feathered warriors. We see it in the petroglyphs surrounding the central kingship figure that has a headdress and is wearing armor. It's the cloth armor, and he has a shield that mimics exactly what the caciques, the high elites, the kings would have been using in battle. And we see that at this petroglyph at Mekonki Ranch. And what's even crazier is I'm pretty sure that the barrio that Cuitlahuac was from, his colors were red and white. And we know that that petroglyph at Mekonki Ranch, the three kings, is also a pictograph. So it's been painted, and the painting is red and white. The feathers and the shielding appears to match what Cuitlahuac would have had in his possession. So I'm 95% sure that it's pointing towards an Aztec king returning to the Uinta Mountains. And the gold disappeared. Cortez was never able to find it. We know exactly how much there was because he had to keep track of it for the king of Spain. So there was 8 tons of treasure. 3,500 pounds of that went missing. Gone. Never recovered.
Wow.
That's not including what else was being hidden. So we're talking about billions of dollars in today's market, you know, in the commodities market. And you know, people say, oh, it's already been found. Well, maybe bits and pieces of it had. But if you put that much treasure on the market, even at the black market, it would collapse the value of gold and silver.
It would be like if De Beers actively told people how common a diamond was.
Right. And then let them all out.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So, and that's just it. Now, especially when you're talking about that much gold. That would take a metrically huge amount of space to hide, you know, that would be large, not just even 35, because a lot of people don't realize how you may hold a gold ring or something, or even a medallion in your hand and feel some weight. But whenever you see like a gold brick in a movie, like a gold brick's like 22 pounds, like that's And that's just something this big. So imagine 3,500 pounds at a minimum, like you said, 3,500 pounds of treasure missing. And then add to that. That's a large amount that you would have to hide somewhere.
Sure. And when you really pay attention to the oral traditions and you look at the very few clues that are left, post destruction of the Aztec Empire, I'm pretty sure that they placed they probably broke it up into probably about five different caches. And four of those caches were miners in case they were being watched and were placed elsewhere, probably in northern Mexico, probably in southern Utah, maybe even in Casa Grande, Arizona, another location, but the majority of it, the large cache was taken all the way back home to the Uinta Mountains.
Well, and you know, when you're talking treasure, things like that, we've got about 15 minutes left, James. Let's switch gears to impact here. Because when you're hunting treasure, things tend to kind of happen. You know, people kind of start following you sometimes, all kinds of things. And, you know, if you go back into earlier seasons of Blind Frog Ranch, you'll see some of that. You'll see claim jumpers people that are adjacent to the property digging on BLM land, all kinds of things. But have you personally experienced anything yet where, you know, people are shadowing you, especially as you're out doing this research in Mexico and in university archives, things like that? Have you experienced anything like that yet?
What I have had is I've had a lot of miners or locals get into contact with me in regards to certain specific finds. And there's two miners. One of them may be listening tonight, but they have amazing information. The data that they have is just tremendous for the hunt that we're on.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get things worked out that hopefully that will be made known at some point. But there are other finds that I know that I can't talk about.
Yeah.
That point towards the Blind Frog Ranch and north of the ranch. So I always tell people, you know, it's 100. And here's another thing. People are like, oh, I can't believe these idiots haven't found the treasure yet. It's only 160 acres. Hey, feel free to come out on it.
Yeah.
It's the most intense wilderness.
Yeah.
There's no flat piece of land anywhere. It's extremely difficult to traverse. And then imagine having to try to get underground.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're having to deal with that too. But the 500 years ago, they weren't going to, you know, stick into a boundary. They were saying, hey, in 500 years, Blind Frog Ranch is going to be here. So let's keep it on here. No, I think something very important is that northern part of Crow Creek that even the Mormons in all of their journals and data were so hell-bent on keeping secret. As a matter of fact, it's really interesting. All the land around Blind Frog Ranch is private, BLM, or reservation, except the north part, which was kept with the state of Utah. And who did that? Brigham Young.
Interesting.
It's extremely interesting when you start piecing together why something like that would have been done and it would have been kept in the state of Utah's hands.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And you know, it goes to a lot of hypotheses that have been out there for years, James, about, you know, the mysterious cave in the Grand Canyon, you know, that was found, where it was even reported that the Smithsonian scientists found things from ancient Egypt and, you know, Greece and all kinds of stuff. And then suddenly the Grand Canyon becomes a national park and you can't go climbing in it like that anymore. You know, and that's one of those that, like, the treasure hunt is on. People are looking all over for it. There was the guy that actively buried treasures all over the Southwest and wrote the book. You know, there's one right down the road in Houston in Herman Park, apparently one of his treasure boxes with a large, I believe it's an emerald inside of the box. And it's fascinating. But once again, it becomes a dangerous world, man. Like, I, sure. I remember back in the day with Dudes and Beer, whenever we had Bingo and Minerva on from the World War II gold show that was happening in the Philippines. And, man, they had helicopters following them from the government, all kinds of things. It was wild, and many things that he couldn't talk about just because of security. You know, it wasn't even producer stuff. It was like, if we say this publicly, like, people will come after us in our camp, you know, it gets pretty sketchy sometimes whenever you're looking for things like that. And it's hard to collaborate because of that. It's hard to want to collaborate because of that. So the fact that you guys have brought other people aboard, the fact that you are out, doing this hard boots on the ground research at archives and things like that, that is really and truly making amazing headway in the hunt, James. Congratulations. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
So, what are the next steps? And of course, you know, you can't really talk about a lot of things because of the show and the fact that there's another part of the season coming out. But as far as you and research and other research, what are your next steps? You know, what new things are you working on? What new equipment are you looking to bring to the table? Things like that.
Yeah, I'm really most focused, spend a lot of my time with the history of the Giants, these people of great stature. Be heading over to Europe here real soon to go to North France and into Belgium. What a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the townships and the cities in that area were supposedly founded by these people of great stature.
Yep.
So trying to map the migration routes from Mount Ararat all the way to the British Isles and things of that nature. And yeah, you have my YouTube channel up there, and I put out a lot of this information already. If people want to go and, you know, hear more about it, they're not too long. They're about 5 to 10 minutes each. And I also was focusing on those Mexico's ancient alien artifacts. I actually found that they're not 8 to 10,000 years at all. They started being created in the 1950s, and I located the original artist. And that's just a whole nother hour we could spend talking about that.
Yeah, we should definitely have you on about that. Because, I mean, a lot of this show, like I love research, James. I am doing my best in the world to try to make science sexy. You know, I've got an 8-year-old. I try to get him involved in every bit of science I can, because if it doesn't carry forward, man, if we don't get younger generations involved and excited and interested in this stuff in a true research aspect beyond the pop culture, you know, in true research aspect, like the idea of finding data, coming up with hypothesis, understanding that observation and experience is the first step in the scientific process. You know, if the apple never fell on Newton's head, would we have a theory of gravity? You know,
sure.
It was the observation,
but it would have been delayed.
sure. You know, or even in a different concept, because the action is what led to it. You know, the experience is what pushed the train forward. So, what can we do to further this kind of research? What can the average person out there listening right now do to get other people interested in this, James?
You know, I think if they go out and I always tell people, look at the show, these reality television shows. It's just like the professors at universities. They're vying for grants to do their research. When you're on television, they're selling commercials time. You know, that's their main thing. So you've got to take away from it what you will, and then go do the research on your own. You know, look into the important things and pass that on, you know, to the younger generations. Because, I mean, heck, treasure hunting is amazing, but it's not the treasure that interests me the most. It's the lost history.
That's it.
The artifacts that will show us this lost history that's probably contained in this treasure. I don't care about the gold. What I care about are the records that were probably on copper, bronze, and gold or brass plates.
Yeah.
That's what I want access to.
Yeah, precisely.
You know, and that's where it becomes just exciting to try to find what's either been lost or destroyed accidentally or on purpose and taken away from us. And it's trying to figure that out. And, you know, it's interesting because all of this started for me by looking into the ancient cultures that were connected between Mesoamerica and Utah, and then to start finding a lot of this paranormal, which is a huge topic of fascination for me, because for these ancient cultures and civilizations, the supernatural controlled them. It
That's
ruled
right.
their day-to-day lives. So there's really no difference. But,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of what I started out on was right above Skinwalker Ranch on that mesa. And there's so much underground in that mesa. And I had those four electromagnetic transient anomalous locations, two above the ranch, one on the ranch, and one just south of the ranch. That's impossible for the data to show what it did. But it did. It was legitimate. It was on TV. The magnetometers, I checked it, did it different times of the day. So we're talking about a much larger area of northeastern Utah that's so important. And probably this energy is what drew the people there. Yep. It's what created the religion, the supernatural, the paranormal. And you got to wonder, did it create, or is all the paranormal drawn to it, you know, or is it both? Yeah. So it's fascinating to me. It's a puzzle that it almost seems like it's never going to be solved, but trying to fit a couple pieces in while I'm alive is the best I can do.
Yeah.
So here I am.
Well, and, you know, once again, the research and the breadth of the research that you have done just in the last 4 years, man, is amazing. And kudos to you, because it is voluminous, it's great, and it is leading once again to whether treasure is found or not, it is changing the history of the localized area. It's bringing a history back to people and bringing a new realm of science to the game when it comes to this kind of stuff. So,
sure. I mean, look, just on this season, we showed that the Ute, it's not even the Utes reservation. It's really the Shoshone's reservation, the Timpanogos people.
Yeah.
You know, the Ute didn't even get there until the late 1880s.
Yeah.
So everything that they've tied into this Ute culture and shifter has to be reevaluated, because we're talking about the Shoshone people, the Timpanogos, and their history is, and it's just really interesting when you delve into what their oral traditions are, especially with giants in the area. It's fascinating. And then it has to make you reevaluate this discussion on the shapeshifters and the skinwalkers, because really that should be moved over to Colorado and New Mexico. That wasn't even a thing in northeastern Utah until the 1990s. So it's fascinating, but it's grown into something, and it almost has the Tulpa effect, people worried about it, thinking about it, actually create it, that like the energy takes a shape or a form of what's on so many people's minds, because so many people are thinking about it.
That's one of the things that we talk about regularly on this show, James, is the fact of even whenever it comes to paranormal investigation, whenever you're preparing your equipment and getting ready to go on an investigation, are you actively reading stories about the place, going and watching stories on YouTube? Like, you may actively be charging the location yourself. You may, and it goes back to the concept of how Putov's paper, which led to the founding of remote viewing, where it's like, you know, and the paper was based on the idea of, are scientists adversely affecting their experiment when they go home and think about it?
Sure.
The idea of like, if you're sitting in traffic and you think like, did I leave my iron on? And if you think it long enough, could you turn your iron on and burn your apartment down?
Or how about the hitchhiker effect? You know, you're controlling that energy and bringing it back with you.
Yeah.
How it manifests then around you. You may not have control after that. It may be affected by those people around you.
And that was quite honestly one of the things that was brought up by the tribal elder that was brought on property this year, was like, no, I'm not going to touch that bead. I'm not going to do that, because I don't want the energy of that bead and what it was set here for to follow me home, to follow me off property. So I'm like, no, I'm not going to touch that, you know, and it's fascinating. And it is something that is ingrained that we honestly as a culture have lost, the idea that we vibrationally affect things as we move through them. So the idea of that and the idea of this property and the idea of, once again, the water moving through copper deposits, moving through iridium, things like that, affecting the local vibration, the magnetic field being perturbed. All these things bring that veil of the paranormal just so much closer, you know?
Sure. And I mean, when you break it down scientifically, everything paranormal is just a shift in a frequency and a wavelength.
Exactly.
It's those two. It's these oscillations that are shifting that create everything around us. I mean, we're a frequency and wavelengths being held together, you know, and it's fascinating how we see it and we just don't quite understand. You know,
And you know, it reminds me a lot of my conversation that I had with Thiago Tietchi, the sole MUFON investigator in Brazil. And I was like, I know that you probably don't get a lot of reports from, you know, communities out in the jungle in São Paulo. But whenever you go out there to maybe, you know, like take a report from somebody in a forestry service or something like that, and you talk to the locals, what do they say about these things? And he's like, oh, to them, it's absolutely normal. Right. Like, they don't come make reports because not only is it a day and a half journey one way by boat, but why would they come report something that their people have been seeing for thousands of years? It's nothing strange to them. It's something strange to us, but it's nothing strange to them. It's part of their oral history. This has been happening forever.
Sure. Star people.
So same thing here. It's one of those, like, we are the ones that are curious about it. To the local indigenous population and things, these are things to be expected. Like, what do you mean you're having a problem? Of course you're having a problem out there. You're not supposed to be drilling near that mountain. What are you doing? Like, it's great to see the progress you guys have made. Once again, it's great to see the progress your research has made and the kudos that it is getting. So, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight, for talking. I'd love to have you back on again to talk about giants in the Southwest and your research into that. Let everybody know where they can go to find your books, James, and where they can go to follow you on YouTube.
Sure. So on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you can go online and get my books. And my YouTube channel is James Keenan, Giants and Paranormal.
Fantastic. James, thank you so much, my friend, for coming on tonight once again.
Thanks for having me.
I greatly appreciate it. I'll be sharing links with you and everything else after the show. Take care, bud. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Take care, Chris. Thanks.
All righty. Well, you are online checking out all of the amazing work of James Keenan, folks, and Blind Frog Ranch, because it really is an amazing show, but his work is absolutely awesome. The trail of clues that he has brought them down through his work into researching ancient civilizations in the Southwest is absolutely phenomenal. So make sure to stop on by and check that out. Make sure to stop on by and subscribe to his YouTube channel. You can find his YouTube channel right over at CuriousRealm.com. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can go to follow not only our YouTube channel, but also all the YouTube channels of our guests, including James Keenan. You can also find all the books, classes, and more from our guests at CuriousRealm.com/store, as well as your copy of the new Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher into the world of the paranormal, cryptids, UFO, UAP, this is your pocket log to write your data down as it occurs in the field so that you will be ready to shake hands with science come that day. Stay tuned through this quick commercial break, everybody. We will be right back with our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News. We will be talking firstly about the White House response to the New Jersey drone flap and the drones across the country, as well as the recent crash in D.C. between a helicopter and a plane, and what the sensationalistic twist to these things as they occur in social media and everything else does to actual investigation and does to actual reporting. We will be getting into that and so much more with our good friend Mike Turber right after this. The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying tuned, and also thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They are your source, just like mine. I have been using True Hemp Science for years. I love their products. I was recommended CBD by my doctor a few years ago for travel anxiety, and it was shortly after that that I began my search across the country as I traveled for work looking for CBD products that worked well. And Christopher Lynch's with True Hemp Science is absolutely amazing. It's made by a spigyric process where every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused until nothing remains, providing a full spectrum CBD product complete with terpene profiles and everything. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to get $50 off, or 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, and two edibles for free as well. In this segment, we are welcoming our good friend Mike Turber, founder of 5x5 News. We owe Mike a lot, folks. Mike Turber is one of those guys that there have been probably at least no less than one handful of occasions over the many years that I know of where I have just called Mike Turber on a Tuesday afternoon and been like, hey, can you be on the show tonight? My guest just dropped out, or, you know, something just happened and I need a guest right now, and he will come on and wreck it and carry the conversation and talk all kinds of topics. But specifically, we have him to thank for quite a bit of our coverage that won us an amazing award. It's only the second time we've ever shown this on air. This is actually from our Dudes and Beer days. But this is relative to tonight. This is the People's Choice Award from 2021 for politics and news. And the reason I'm showing that tonight is because we are not a sensationalistic program, folks. We don't do a lot of sensationalism. We will gladly cover the topics that are sensationalistically being covered in the news and by other programs out there. However, my job, I've always considered it, is to have a show that makes you not only think, but demystifies things, and to follow. I will address conspiracies. I will address facts that are out there. I will look at them in different lights. Absolutely. However, I do not follow the rabbit holes of fear and conspiracy that are set up and so often dismissed. Two of the prime examples that we will be talking about tonight with Mike Turber are the drone situation in New Jersey, which we just heard from the White House about. So we'll be discussing in the first part with Mike Turber, who comes on typically to talk about security things, military things, security contractor things, that kind of stuff. He is steeped in that world of intelligentsia and counterintelligence, things like that. So we'll be talking with him about that. And in addition, we will be addressing what we know right now about the DC plane and helicopter crash that happened. It has been all over social media. It's been all over the conversations in discussion groups all over social media. And we are going to dispel a lot of the myths tonight. We are going to cover a lot of the facts that are there and hopefully help provide a sieve through which things can be sifted, everybody, because unfortunately, sensationalism happens so fast, things move so fast that media tries to keep up with things in order to trend on social media, things like that. And that doesn't always mean that they're waiting for an investigation to happen. It doesn't always mean that they are waiting for the facts to come through. So we need to consider those things. And that is why our good friend Mike Turber is here to help us kind of sift through some of this fact and fiction. Welcome back, Mike Turber. How are you doing, my friend?
I am doing excellent. Excellent. And congratulations again on that award you got. I think it was one of the first shows when after you got that. And I remember how much that meant to you, that it was the People's Choice Award. And, you know, I mean, you can't get anything better than that in this field, as far as, you know, listening to the people who listen to you talk about, hey, this show is really good, and this show is something we respect. And the guy put out the list of the people you were up against. That was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you came out on top, and I'm so proud of you for that. That was an amazing moment.
Well, it was coverage from things like our Route 91 coverage. And, you know, even whenever we were approached by members of Anonymous, stuff like that. Those are the compliments, Mike, and people like you being involved with things like the Route 91 investigation, us being able to get things from you as they happen and help dispel those myths to the facts of the case that were, you know.
I was your boots on the ground.
Well, that to me is what it's about, you know, because investigations are not won overnight. They're rarely solved within 48 hours, you know, and it's one of those that you really do have to wait for facts to shake out. You know, and I remember I was at the MUFON symposium in DFW in Dallas this year, in Irving, actually, when the Trump assassination attempt happened. And my old boy, Stephen Bishop, you know him, man, he was watching the inauguration, watching the footage and on it, and texted me like as soon as it happened. Like, hey, man, like, and I started digging, I started looking, and somebody came out and was like, you know, Trump was just shot. And I was like, whoa, 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 hold on. Shots have been fired at the Trump rally. Should be the headline here. We do not know if Trump has been shot yet.
Right.
You know?
And once they got what they thought was the earshot, that's when everybody started just going nuts with it.
Well, it came out hours later that he was nicked by the bullet and everything else. But originally, all the people were saying was, you know, Trump was shot, Trump was shot, Trump was shot. Mm-hmm. It's like, yo, hold on. And that's the tendency, Mike, is to go to the end conclusion. And unfortunately, sometimes the want is to go to a far conclusion and a far reaching conclusion. And frequently that is a situation of correlation is not causation. You know, just because two things happen to coincide does not mean that one was caused by the other. And we'll be getting into some of that tonight, beginning with the drones. Let's start there, man, because I remember, you know, we had our friend, Anthony S. and Play on, that was episode 159. So this is 166 All of 6 weeks ago, we had Anthony on talking about the New Jersey drones. And that was such a situation that when we first interviewed him, I called him back and was like, hey, man, so much of what we said in that pre-record has actually come to bear. The fact of it rapidly moved to, you know, let's have a meeting. Let's have an emergency meeting.
Yeah, you had to have an update before your show even aired.
So. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, because, we recorded the update, the hearing was happening, you know. Right. And that's when we found out that the FBI has a $500,000 budget nationally for drone mitigation
technology. They may lose that. They may lose it.
It's the only budget they have. That's barely even the cost of a good industrial drone, you know?
Or the cost of two really good experts that would work it. But, I saw that as you answered the phone, it just popped up on the screen. It says FBI, UAP, blah, 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 may lose funding over the January 6th situation. So everything's ties together.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that plays out. Hopefully they won't. They'll keep it going.
Speaking of DC and speaking of the White House and speaking of the drones, let's hear the actual press conference release. I would say it's not even a press conference or anything like that. There weren't a whole lot of questions answered. There weren't a whole lot of questions taken. But here is the statement from the White House themselves, everybody.
I do have news directly from the President of the United States that was just shared with me in the Oval Office from President Trump directly, an update on the New Jersey drones. After research and study, the drones that were flying over New Jersey in large numbers were authorized to be flown by the FAA for research and various other reasons. Many of these drones were also hobbyists, recreational, and private individuals that enjoy flying drones. In time, it got worse due to curiosity. This was not the enemy. A statement from the President of the United States.
And there you have it, folks. That was the very, very blunt statement. And what I had to keep reminding people of on social media, Mike, is that the FAA is like the FCC. All right. While they'll have investigations into things and stuff like that, you know, and while they're in charge of air traffic controllers and that kind of stuff, what they are is a licensing and regulatory commission. That's mainly what they are. So if you have a flight plan to file, that's where it goes, you know, things like that. And when you go to register, just like registering a plane, you have to register a drone and you have to register what you're using it for. You know, and these drones were registered for research. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. And one of the things that very early on, you know, because people send me videos to debunk or to say, you know, because a lot of people I know and two of them that over that time period were senators. So I had two senators send me the video. And one of them said, hey, so I don't have egg on my face. Can you tell me what this is? You know, can I talk about it? And I said, well, if I tell you what it is, you can talk about it. I mean, because if I analyze something, it doesn't matter if it's military or non-military or foreign government or whatever. That's up to you. It's your decision. But I started looking at it and I tried to match the light patterns and stuff like this. And I found out what it was. And as time progressed, it was this hysteria thing that just, you know, grew out of all of this. I think a vast majority of what we were experiencing was not necessarily much more drone activity, although it did seem it did seem like it was a good bit. But more people were looking up, more people were paying attention. And as such, more people see things. And I got so many videos of normal planes and things like that. But some of them were very strange. I have to admit, there's a couple of them where to this moment, I still don't necessarily know what it was. I think it was something per se, but to the stretch that people were making that it was a Chinese ship that was off the coast or an Iranian ship off the coast launching these things at us. That's when I start to question the motivation of people who make that initial announcement. Like, okay, is this a form of clickbait? Or are you looking, you know, who is doing this? Is this someone like a, you know, an AJ, which, you know who I mean by AJ, do that and sensationalize things to get more people to listen in. And that works.
Absolutely. 1,000% of the time. Work. I will say proudly, the other day in the background, I heard my son talking to his tablet while he was watching a video. And he said, "Man, if this is clickbait, I'm going to track you down and expose you." My kid's not even eight yet, folks. So to hear him like internet warrior, you know, like, "I'm going to find you and expose you for your clickbait."
That's crazy.
That's absolutely awesome. And that's just it. You know, it's one of those, the chase for the headline doesn't allow you to wait for the investigation and wait for facts. And when you're chasing the headline, and that's the problem, is that tomorrow when facts come out, now the headline has to change. Now the slant on it has to change, you know, and the way that you cover it has to change.
And even when we look in the areas that we dabble in, we have to find a balance between the acceptance and understanding and all this other stuff. When people come to us with something, I don't want to take away their experience. I can't do that. So if someone experiences something, that you can't say didn't happen. Whatever happened, that happened. There's nothing you can say. But when somebody hands you a video and says, "Hey, can you tell me what this is?" I look at it from that standpoint, from a factual, "Hey, we need to know what this is. Is this a foreign entity? Is this someone local that's terrorizing the local community, or were they flying where they're not supposed to fly, and all these different things? And does this drone have capabilities that might cause an issue? Because look what's happening in Ukraine, where, you know, these normal consumer drones have been converted into and weaponized." As such, that gives some of the people that, you know, are not of 100% mental state here in the country some ideas. And ideally, you don't really want to foster that. So that's why I think that a lot of this needs to be not censored, but the people need to be self-governing over some of the things that they report and sensationalize. And it's frustrating because, you know, we're not the popular ones when we talk about the factual matters. It's the ones that say, "Oh, it's this or it's that," or, you know, "It's Iranian." And then everybody goes, "What? I didn't hear that." And of course, and it takes off.
And I'll scroll through some of the, because a lot of people, you know, just so you know, folks, hop on out, join the Curious Realm group on Facebook. It's an open group. There are a few questions, things like that, but it is not a private group. It is there for these conversations. And frequently I'll post something and somebody I know will text me like, "Hey, you just posted that thing that you posted." And I'm like, yeah, but it's from another source. You know, so you'll see sources that agree and don't agree with what you think about the same topic. You'll see sources from abroad about the same topic, things like that. And right now I'm just going to screenshot and scroll through in real time some of the actual articles that I posted. I went on and searched for New Jersey in the group. Mystery as radioactive shipment goes missing in New Jersey. Drone mystery. New Jersey homeowners threaten to take matters into their own hands if government doesn't act.
Oh, boy.
You know, mysterious New Jersey drone sightings prompt call for state of emergency. Like New Jersey lawmakers meet with security officials after weeks of unexplained drone sightings. It goes on and on and on and on.
Man fires tracer rounds at drone as it flies near his home.
And that's why we had our friend Anthony on, because that was his video that they made to make fun of the thing. And it was literally picked up by news agency. One news agency actively said that their person, boots on the ground, shot the video. That's where it goes,
people.
You know, so Anthony Esemplaya out there, I'm sorry to hear about your YouTube channel. We will definitely be sharing out the new one. We need to have you on to talk about the cancellation of the YouTube channel. But good Lord, the stuff he was posting about it, absolutely amazing, mm-hmm. absolutely awesome, you know, and in real time posting it, man. And it's one of those we've got to be able and we've got to be willing. I say it pretty regularly on the show and whenever I speak live about red circles and not only presenting red circles, but examining red circles. Hey, as the investigator, we need to be willing to take in red circles. Doesn't matter how many heartbreaks we've had or how many constant people we meet with the red circles. We have to be willing to keep looking at red circles. And leave the experience for what it is, because once again, the red circle and the explanation of what's in it does not remove the experience of how you got that picture.
Right.
And what it meant to you.
The emotional attachment that someone has to something like that is profound.
Hugely.
And I have had situations where when I've explained, because I thought it was calming someone down. I thought it was like letting them know, hey, it's okay. It's not what you thought it was. It's this or this or this, which I thought would calm them down. And in some cases, it just happened to be the reverse. So I had to wow, I got to learn the psychology of all of this, because it's important that you help people and not steer them the wrong way or whatever.
Or further traumatize them if they were traumatized by an experience, you know. And that's just it. Stating things as a definite can be hard. And even as an investigator, even as someone like myself who looks at tons of footage, pictures, things like that, has spent years editing and working on those things and gathering those things, you know, there are things that we can see and identify right off. You know, somebody today had a pretty decent picture, but a little bit blurry, of the moon and the recent alignment with Venus, which is at its brightest right now. And I've had to inform them and show them like a screenshot from the approximate time that they were talking about that night of the stars at night, you know, from sky maps, and be like, unfortunately, that was Venus. It just happens to be during this alignment. It's very, very close and about four or five times brighter than normal, you know?
Yeah. And so, my number one video on TikTok is that 3.5 million or something like that. And it's of a story of a pilot, you know, trying to – he basically took a nap or whatever and come back on the flight deck. And the co-pilot had said that there had been some military traffic in the area. And, of course, he sits down, puts his headgear on, and looks out the window. And next thing you know, he puts the plane into a dive to avoid hitting Venus.
Yeah,
because he thought that was a plane coming right at him. And that was a huge CNN story. So, but yeah, I mean, these things happen. And, you know, how it's resolved, I guess, is over time, is through education and having channels like yours that explore both sides in a very equal fashion. And that's greatly appreciated. And I think your listeners know that you give a fair shake to both sides and you weigh in on it. And when you feel it's this or that, then you say it.
Well,
but you leave enough room for everybody to feel comfortable, and that's important. And you do that well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. For me, it's the fact of, you know, you've got to be able to stand in the middle of everything. Yeah. If my exploration and actual research requires it too much, you know, if I get too passionate about something, the problem is, now I'm standing in hot water regularly and I don't know if the water starts boiling, you know, it's hard to tell if the water is getting hot if you're already standing in hot water, you know, and same thing if I'm utterly cold, you know, I may be cold and methodical about the way that I explain things, stuff like that, but it's also because there's with that red circle comes the experience, and we have to understand that first step in the scientific process is experience. It's where it starts. It's experience and observation, you know? So without either one, either the paranormal or the science doesn't begin. So they're both rooted in the same thing.
Yeah, we still go through the same steps to basically, you know, some things are just so obvious that you just want to not have to go through the steps. But when you do, you know, it's best to show, okay, I'm going to analyze this and we're going to find out what this was. Are you okay with whatever the answer is? And then they're like, oh yeah, I definitely want to know what it is. And then when you come back and you tell them what it is, most people, you know, they're like, oh, okay. Well, my wife will feel better about that because, you know, I thought it was blah, blah, blah. And she was freaking out, you know, these kind of things. And that happens. And if, as long as you can have a calming effect, this New Jersey thing, however, took on a life of its own. And I think it was partly fed through media, definitely social media, but even mainstream media jumped on the bandwagon and basically pushed the narrative that was, you know, driving people to their channels to watch shows and sell advertising, whatever it is they do. And us guys out here that are saying, hey, you two girls that are driving around filming that thing out the window, I can tell you what that is, some of those you just it boggles the mind, and our voices are just not as loud. Well, but over time,
even what you brought up earlier, the mere phenomena of now people are looking, and when you start looking at a swath of sky on a regular basis that normally is just the background as you're driving by to work, you know. When you start actively looking, then yes, these things that are actively there and pretty commonplace, you may start seeing them, you know, as opposed to just an airplane or something like that. Well, and when you have more people looking, you're going to see more. And when you have people flying more drones to check things out, you're going to see more drones suddenly. So,
well, it's like at the beginning with Starlink, when that the number of sightings for Starlink was unbelievable. And after a while, you're like, wow, this hasn't really saturated yet to the point where most people would look up and go, oh yeah, the Starlink, you know, and just automatically know what it is. And I think now it's pretty much done that. But then, of course, when they lost the Starship over the Turks and Caicos Islands a couple of weeks back or a few weeks back, you know, you listen to the people go, wow, what is that? Oh my gosh. And it's beautiful. I mean,
it was gorgeous.
Beautiful sight to see. Yeah, especially
billions of dollars of gorgeous.
Exactly. So it was pretty. But, you know, a satellite comes down about once a day. We get one a day. We're pretty much with the Starlink system, you're going to have about one every 2 days that are going to be re-entering. And that's a lot. That is a lot. And so people see that. And my thoughts go back to the Challenger, you know, incident, but
which just passed. Me, really.
Yeah. So and that happens in my mind. And but you start to see the people's reactions to this is so natural and such a standard human emotion. When you see something, you don't understand what it is. You stand there in awe and you don't know whether to be afraid or to be mystified or to go, wow, this is beautiful. I'm going to film this entire event, not like film 2 seconds and run. But, you know, and the other thing with SpaceX, when they do their launches close to dusk or dawn and they have the jellyfish effect.
Yeah.
That is, I've seen that several times now. And that is just a beyond phenomenal instance where I could see where people go, wow, that has to be not from this earth, but this is going to be a lot more. There's going to see a lot more of this. There's a lot more drones. I mean, we knew this years ago when the number of drones was just taking off like crazy.
I was going to say the difference is, though, what most people think of as drone, Mike, you know, I don't know. I go to CES regularly.
Yeah.
You know, I go the Consumer Electronics show, folks, not just to throw an acronym out at you. It's a Consumer Electronics show. It's been happening about 50 years. Tons of new tech is released there every year. Autonomous drones. I've seen autonomous taxis, all kinds of stuff. I've ridden in them. I've seen these things fly. I've seen the drone soccer league. all kinds of things. And you went to SHOT Show, you know, mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff regularly where they have armed drones and armed dogs and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So the, and some of these things are well beyond the size of your average DJI drone or what they use. Even whenever you think about what is used for film and video work, real film work, folks, where you are carrying a camera that weighs about, you know, 15 pounds, 20 pounds, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking about drones with a 20 kilogram capacity. But they also have to be big enough to carry the battery for that 20 kilogram capacity, you know?
Yeah, the batteries weigh more than the camera. And some of the batteries I have are 6 and 7 pounds just for the battery.
Well, and that's just it. Once you start getting into that commercial grade of drone, and especially things mm-hmm. that are autonomous drones, you know, stuff for pipeline inspection where it's going to take off, follow a pre-programmed flight path, gather data, and come back every day, you do not need an operator for that. You need somebody to check on it when it goes bad, you know? So those things are operated by Raspberry Pis and GPS, and they are receiving a GPS signal, but everything else is optically done with fiber optics inside. So it's not like there's a signal there to intercept and bring down. And
well, it's on the consumer side, you have the drones are, you're supposed to stay within line of sight.
Yep.
Once you get your part 107 license, you can actually, you know, fly beyond your line of sight. But of course, FAA wants you to just stay within that realm. But I've flown my drone out 5 miles before. And I remember standing there at a Walmart one time waiting for a SpaceX launch. And so I figured, well, let me get above the cloud deck here and take a look at it. And people come up to me, you know, where's your drone? They're looking up. They know I'm flying it, but they can't see it or hear it.
Yeah.
And I said, I had to go up about X number, you know, 1700 feet. And I'm about 2 miles down this way. And they're like, what? And they find it hard to believe. But we fly drones from here around the world using satellites.
That's right.
You know, and some of these drones have flight times that are that rival that of commercial airliners, up to 12 hours.
Yep.
A lot of people see these drones and they're thinking, well, they're only going to be up there for 10, 15 minutes. No, some of these drones are designed to stay up for a while. I mean, we've got crop duster drones that just are autonomous, where they take off at a certain time, they come down and they refill their tanks and go up and start spraying again. You know, it's amazing that, you know, what we're seeing. And of course, at night, if you're driving out in the farmlands and you see this craft flying around close to dusk or dawn or whatever, and if they fly at night, fine. You'd probably be hard pressed to tell what it was.
Yeah.
But one thing I can assure you is that I seriously doubt that anyone's going to come from many light years away and come here with lights flashing, blinking, and things like that.
Accidentally leave the hazards on. That's just it.
The FAA approved hazards.
The FAA lights are pretty visible on most of these objects that have been filmed. And once again, Anthony Esemplea had one that was huge, like the size of a Mini Cooper, over his house.
Yeah.
You know, that he had footage of.
Well, the Matrix, the DJI Matrix is like that. There's several, like the 8-arm, you know, the ones of the police drones. I got to fly a couple of those. And you can fly, the person that flies the drone is not the person that flies the camera. It's just like on my Inspire.
That's right.
I could have a controller for someone to fly the camera and I fly the drone. So you don't have to worry about doing both. But, when you see some of the things that, you know, the imagery that these things are able to produce, if you look up the term Pegasus and put drone, you'll see what that was going to be. It was going to be a live broadcast of your entire city where they could zoom in on a 200 gigapixel, not megapixel, gigapixel image and have live coverage of the entire city. That actually flew and is a real thing. And Hillsborough County accidentally revealed that they have one. This was about a year ago when Chronister, which is the sheriff, brought someone into his little war room and was able to show in real time a image from anywhere in the city at any time just by a push of a button. And literally the craft was already in the air, and all you're doing is telling it to zoom in on this part of the image. You didn't even have to aim the camera. It literally is an entire image of the entire area, and you can zoom in on a certain area and another operator can zoom in on a certain area on the same image and not affect each other. That is amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And you know, it's fascinating to me the technology that is out there, Mike, that, you know, mm-hmm. once again, automation, all kinds of things. And that has even been brought up with the Blackhawk thing. Let's kind of switch paces here now mm-hmm. and move into that, because, you know, that does bring up the idea that all of a week or so before, and I'll find that footage real quick inside of our Facebook. But mm-hmm. all of a week or so before the DC crash was the announcement of the automated Blackhawk.
Mm-hmm.
The pilotless Blackhawk that can carry out mission, everything else, go drop gear, what have you, without risking the life of soldiers. And a lot of people are saying that was an automated Blackhawk that took over.
No, I listened to the pilots or listened to the people on board. So I think it was like 13 minutes after that first announcement came out, I started going in and listening to the live ATC control, which anyone can do. You can do it through Broadcastify mm-hmm. and radio reference and things like that. And also live ATC, I think it's liveatc.com. And you can listen to these things as they happen. And I suggest that people do that when an event is occurring, listen to the actual transmissions that are happening at the scene, whether it's a crime, whether it's a national emergency or a natural disaster, whatever it is, listen to the people that we have on the ground that do the rescue work, that do the investigations, or the air traffic controllers that immediately have to reroute all that air traffic out of the area because they're closing the airport. All of these things that you listen to. And that's exactly what happened that night. The air traffic controller that handled that flight, you could hear it in his voice. Once he realized what had happened, and you could hear the woman in the background at the air traffic control center, which is the ATC center at the facility at Reagan International. Once you heard her gasp in the background, you knew immediately that was the moment that it had happened, because they were looking out the window. They could see that flash out the window. It was that close to runway 33. It was just off the end of runway 33. And that sense of listening to them and how they handle this, number one, it shows you the amount of training that they have to go through to do that. I took air traffic control training at Florida State Community College in Jacksonville. And when I went through that, learning all of the things that they have to know about routing air traffic, because they have to be almost like a pilot and know a bunch of other stuff. And it gets very hectic. Very hectic. And that was the days when Reagan fired everybody.
And I was playing that video of the automated thing, the automated Blackhawk. And you mentioned the air traffic controller, and something very important to bring up is the fact that the DC airport there that happened at has been horribly understaffed, according to FAA regulation and recommendations from the ATC union, ATC being air traffic controller, folks, or air traffic mm-hmm. control. But the ATC union recommends 30 air traffic controllers for there. There are 19. So right now they've got 19 people running shifts ranging up to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. You know, the air traffic controller that was there had just about 40 minutes earlier been left on his own during shift change, stuff like that, and mm-hmm. was covering both frequencies, because it's not like they're on the same frequency, folks. There is a airline frequency and a helicopter frequency. And typically there's an air, right. air traffic controller assigned to both, because while their pads cross, they're different. Like helicopters are capped to 200 feet in that airspace.
And there was a corridor that they fly through. And one thing I immediately did is I tried to get the actual radar data to look at. So, you know, flight aware and all this other stuff. And so as I'm looking at this, I'm visualizing myself being the pilot of either craft, the CRJ or the Blackhawk. And as such, when I started positioning my nose in the direction of landing out on 33 and listening to the Pat, you know, it was basically Pat 25, you know, do you have the CRJ in sight? And Pat 25 passed behind the CRJ. And I honestly think that the pilot was looking at the aircraft ahead and to the left and not the aircraft that was essentially that it was right on top of to begin with. And I don't know if that'll come out in the watch or whatever, but I went and watched a couple of the pilot forums that I visit periodically.
Well,
and several said the same thing. It just seemed that it was an easy oversight to do, but they asked several times do you, they wanted visual separation, which is a common thing. It's not uncommon at all. But then, you know, after the last, the helicopter pilot went radioed back saying Pat 25 is aircraft in sight and request visual separation. 13 seconds later, that was it.
Well, and that's something important to consider is the fact that in that airspace, helicopters are on a visual flight path while airplanes are on an instrumented flight path, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's no different than a distracted driver, though, folks. Absolutely no different than like, I looked up and suddenly there was a car there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The only difference is you're moving at hundreds of miles an hour instead of 35. That's the only difference.
Right.
And you're in something that weighs a ton or a couple tons, you know. But here is the actual video, once again, from our friend Anthony Esemplea's original YouTube channel. Here is the actual video of the crash, and you can hear some of that audio from air traffic control.
503,000, American 3130.
Yeah, we have
Harvard
6.
Lucy 5347, go around, climb, maintain 3,000, fly power.
The crash just happened.
Go around, 3,000, blue streak 5347.
And, yeah, it's...
Black check 3, can you return to base?
It's crazy to see it happen in real time. And once again, that air traffic audio, and the fact is that the way that the radios work, especially the two frequencies with the one operator... Mm-hmm. That operator's flipping back and forth between frequencies. And even while he's flipping back and forth between frequencies, the plane can't talk to the helicopter and the helicopter can't talk to the plane. You know, that's just the way the radios work.
There's a buffer there too. And there's a buffer the commercial side. Normally when they freak over to the military, they will generally handle all the military aircraft in a row at one time. They'll just say, you know, Pat 25, Pat 26, you know, whatever. And they'll run them down the river in that corridor. But the commercial airlines are a bit different because you've got different airlines, different aircraft, different runways and different, you know, places they need to go. So this tragedy is probably going to change that whole corridor right there because it's
absolutely
very congested.
Well, it's one of the most congested airspaces. And you know, there it is from Forbes, the DC plane crash live updates. Reagan Air Traffic Control Tower was reportedly understaffed. Mm-hmm. And
keep in mind the reason why it's contested, a lot of this or congested is a lot of the airspace. You're talking about Washington, D.C., and you're talking about the Pentagon's there, you're talking about Virginia where you got CIA headquarters, all this other stuff, then you got D.C. So a lot of the airspace forces the aircraft to fly over the Potomac.
That's right.
Because they have no like permanent NOTAMs, which is a notice to airmen. And those bottlenecks are where this is happening. So you've got these aircraft that are channeled in to all come into the same basic vector that they're vectoring in for that runway 33 or yeah. 15 or any of these other runways. And that's a lot of aircraft in a very small portion of space. And,
precisely.
These things, we haven't had a collision in decades. It's been a while.
Yeah, and it's
for a commercial.
There's definitely been a string of things. We've talked about Boeing before, and there's definitely been a string of incidents, like a plane just caught fire on the runway in Houston, all kinds of stuff. So, and here I am flying to Hawaii on Friday.
Where are you flying? What aircraft?
I'm on Southwest, so it's a Boeing.
Oh, it's a Boeing, yeah. Guaranteed.
But at the same token, it's one of those, like, man, that's like saying, you know, all the Toyotas have come back that were recalled. You know, they're still out there on the road, folks. Once again, to speak to the sensationalism that happens with these stories, we've just talked about some of the facts, some of the things that have come out. There was the fact that it was possibly a disgruntled DEI pilot, you know, a pilot who was transgender, who's a helicopter pilot. And they named the lady, and come to find out, she had to take to social media and say, "Hi, nice to meet you. I'm the transgender helicopter pilot you're talking about, who's still alive." So that wasn't it. It was possibly that, you know, there was a Russian ice skater on board that knew Putin's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, if that was going to be the case, folks, they could handle that with a pellet of polonium and a rose a whole lot easier after an ice skating competition, you know, and just take them out the same way that they did Putin's competition to get in office, with a polonium handshake, you know?
Exactly.
So there's a thousand ways that they would quietly do that without taking to the skies with an accident.
You got to keep in mind, each time there's an event like this, there seems to be a mad dash for someone to watch the video or to gather some of the information and have enough truthful information, but something will look a little odd, and then they will run with it. I mean, just absolutely run with it. And to the point where after a while you start to think, well, if you do that enough times, eventually people will pull away from that program. But no, that's not the case in many cases. It just seems to appeal to a certain group, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But over time, you start to wonder what's going on with our country, and with the way we're taught to think, the way we're taught to, you know, critically think, or to problem solve and things like that. But it does get entertaining at times too, but in sad situations, it's unfortunate, but it is not entertaining. It's kind of hurtful in a lot of ways, you know, and we could name some schools and some shootings. Yeah. Where that backfires, it's not a good thing.
Well, and that's just it. You know, it's like we say all the time, and why we did the episode that we did about the Netflix documentary with Peter Robbins, about Peter Robbins with Earl Grey, you know, about the New York UFO incident, the Brooklyn Bridge incident, because it's important to the community. When reports like that come out, when slanted things like that come out, and you slyly go behind somebody's back, get their permission to film them talking about their experience and talking about the research of that experience, and then use it for a totally different purpose than what you told them you were going to use it for, that's deceptive journalism.
It's Netflix. They did it with Tiger King.
The problem is you're doing it for sales, and that's great. It popped up some numbers, most definitely. But the problem is, what does it do for the conversation, and what does it do for the experiencers who have to come forward when they find out that an experiencer was contacted by Netflix or a representative who sold something to Netflix, and Netflix purchased it, and they don't even know the fact that this person got this person's permission to do the documentary about them, but that they're representing it in a totally different light, you know,
and they're using it.
It's no good. It's not good for the community. It's not good for research.
the Showtime UFO special that I was going to be a part of, and I, you know, the situation I had, I won't bring it back up, but you know, we were going to essentially kind of get to the inside of the UFO community, and that was the wrong thing. And once I said, "Hey, wait a minute, this is," even though part of it was a mutual idea, there was a certain point where I said, "Wait, this isn't right. This isn't the right way to do things."
That's right.
And it's just like what I experienced with Carol Baskin and Howard Baskin from the Tiger King. When I listened to this, I saw the emails that Carol got. I spoke to Rebecca and Eric Good, the people that made Tiger King, and went through this whole thing and became friends with Carol and stuff. And you start to see how this hoodwink thing happens. And over time, you start realizing, wow, this seems to be the norm in some cases with certain types of journalism. You know, Carol was told it was going to be Blackfish. And then you look at the UAP stuff versus the UFO stuff, and you see a very similar mode where they're almost, people are driven to say a story a certain way,
yeah,
only to have it come back on them later.
That's right.
And that's sad. You can't do that, especially when it's an abduction, you know, something that is that emotional.
Yeah.
No, it's not the right thing to do. That's gaslighting
just the fact
and all this other stuff.
It's a sensational way to conduct what is, quote, journalism. And if you're trying to be journalistic, if you're trying to be a researcher, then you've got to wait to form your opinion. You've got to wait till data comes in. It's still a hot investigation. Right. They aren't going to share every bit of the investigation with you as they investigate. That's not how they do it.
Right.
They aren't going to have a press conference an hour. It's not how it works. They may wait weeks now that things have happened. But it did come out. You know, I had it up on screen just at January 31st. I posted the article from Fox talking about two planes reportedly aborted landings at D.C. in the last week due to helicopters and near collision. So that, like, once again, it's a regular thing. If you've ever flown into Reagan, you know what a hairy airport it is. You can see the air traffic that's around there. You see it right out your window as you're cruising along the Potomac coming in. So it's a crazy busy corridor. There have been numerous near misses. There are regular near misses there. This just happens to be a horrible, horrible conjunction of situations. It doesn't have to be the case. And, you know, unfortunately, there's no vetted evidence that it was done to kill a Russian ice skater. There is no vetted evidence that there was an automated helicopter used. There is no, much like the fact that it was possibly an angry transgender DEI pilot. No, not at all.
Yeah.
Perfectly still alive. Not even part of the flight crew. So, you know, we have to, it is incumbent upon us to wait for data to come in order to properly research something. You know, you can keep up with stories as they happen, but keep them as a piece of data in a data set.
Yeah.
You can't just,
It's more important to get it right than to get it sensationalized.
Than
to get it first, exactly. And I fell into that category a couple of times because I would get the data pretty much first, and I would put it out there, and then sometimes I was right, sometimes I was wrong, but
that's,
I would try to tell people, this is the data as I'm getting it, and I am live trying to basically disseminate this information and give you my interpretation and my opinion on what I'm looking at this time. And a number of people would come back, but you said the other day that blah, blah, blah. And yes, after more careful analysis, I was able to determine that this was blah, 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 instead of what I initially said, which is what a lot of investigations do. And a good investigator and a good journalist will do just that. They will go through, and if they're, you know, because a lot of journalists just report from, you know, the scene, or, and they interpret things as they see them live and stuff like this. But most journalists are, they're researchers. They go back and they research things, and then they try to put it into a palatable story that, you know, that everyone can understand. And the difference is that when you're trying to, like I was in Vegas and trying to tell people what was going on, and of course there was the multiple shooter thing, and there was all these different,
that's right,
different scenarios that were playing out. And I was trying to dispel all these that weren't based in fact. And yet these other, you know, other channels that come out and people who are, you don't know what you're talking about. It had to be the Saudis and it had to be this and it had to be, you know, multiple this. And after a while you get frustrated yourself, but you stay the course, the course and get it accurate.
Well,
and you'll still be here in the long run.
And, you know, I just had a headline up on screen. That's one that can lead people either direction with the headline. It's out of Reuters, you know, crashed U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter unit was responsible for doomsday readiness. So you could take that either way, you know. It's more the fact of we're now one less unit who's highly trained in the area of doomsday readiness down. You know, so is it the fact that they used an automated helicopter to take them down to lower our readiness? Like what's the hypothesis there then? You know, and that's just it. That's where the modicum, of correlation is not causation comes from. You know, the fact that they happen to be in charge of doomsday ready, if they're based out of DC, man, I'd be willing to bet.
Yeah.
That they're part of doomsday readiness.
The landing site right there at FEMA's headquarters, you know. So, you know, and even like you and I both have talked to Kevin Day and with the Nimitz event, when you think about how they were interpreting data in real time and, you know, sending information out to the pilots and saying, hey, we have a UAP that's, you know, in this area. Of course, at the time they didn't call them UAPs, but you know, something unidentified was in this area, and we need to send you to check it out, because that was, Kevin was responsible for that airspace and the safety of it. And to hear the possibility could exist that it was a training thing.
Yeah.
And that just went against every grain in his body. And I agree with him 100%. If it, in fact, was that, then that's a problem. But there's other end of the spectrum where you go, well, how are you going to be able to test your pilots if you don't test them in a real time, real scenario situation, with, you know, dummy, you know, missiles on the plane, you know, nothing's going to come off the rail, but you know, those scenarios, I could see both sides of that issue.
And we've had that conversation on the show. Could it have been some sort of exercise? Quite possibly, you know, but they definitely wouldn't have, somebody would have been briefed on it. Somebody would have been briefed on it. Even if they were using electronic pods, like we'd stated before, the infrared lasers, what have you, you know, somebody would have been briefed on the fact that they were testing radar that day for that specific technology. And that's just it. You know, we have to take, and until proven otherwise, everybody, until everything's pickled, you have to put salt and sugar with it, you know? So until it's ready, like it's one of those, you've got to wait for all the ingredients to come together for the story.
If you don't, it's gonna taste a little sour. So, you know, wait till everything is matured and tastes good. Otherwise it's not gonna come across that well. And same thing with me with the documentary I've been trying to get out about the three Navy videos that came out, and you know, speaking of the Nimitz event and stuff.
Yep.
In fact, there is a new witness to the Nimitz event that Dave Beatty, I just talked to him earlier today. Dave Beatty is the guy that did the Nimitz Encounters video that most people have seen. If they're in the UFO community, you definitely have seen it. And so there is a new, not whistleblower, but there is a new witness to the original Nimitz UFO event, UAP event, or what have you, that is coming forward. He's in the midst of getting vetted by Dave Beatty right now, but Dave went ahead and made the announcement. So I look forward to that, because it'll be new and more information. So I send a note over to Kevin. We'll see how that plays out. So, and we haven't heard any new witnesses from that event for a very long time, like years.
Yeah.
So this should be interesting. Should be interesting.
Exactly. It'll be fascinating to see what comes out, and I can't wait to see what happens, because it's going to be awesome, Mike. Thank you so much for your time today, bud, as always, especially breaking apart topics like this, because it's a sensitive one. It's out there, you know, and it's one that we've got to keep cooler heads. We have to let cooler heads prevail. We have to. I'm sorry, folks. I hate saying it, but we have to have some kind of trust in a system. And even like we kept saying about the drones the whole time, there doesn't seem to be anything truly, truly strange going on here other than an uptick in the number of drones. And when you're talking a bunch of people out there looking at drones, looking for drones, and putting drones in the air to look for drones, you're going to see a lot more drones. You know, that's just a metric thing.
Exactly.
You
Good point.
And the prime example is start looking around your house for spiders. You'd be surprised how many you find. You may not see a bunch of cobwebs everywhere. You may, because you ain't specifically looking for spiders and where they're hiding and how they're hiding. But boy, howdy, I guarantee you the statistic of you're no further than 10 to 15 feet away from a spider, almost guaranteed, you know? They're there. It's just that you aren't looking for them on a regular basis. So that's why you may not be seeing them in that kind of quantity or in that kind of way. Now that people are keyed in, it's different. So,
And we won't tell you how many you possibly eat in a year.
That's right.
According to certain studies.
That's right.
We don't mention that.
but it's always great having you on. It's always great demystifying these things with you, going over this information with you. Let everybody know. We'll pop up the channel on YouTube and everything, but let everybody know where they can go to follow you and the work of 5x5 News, Mike.
Sure. The easiest thing to do is just do a Google search for 5x5 News. You'll find us on Twitter. You'll find me on TikTok. Seems to be where I'm going to hang out probably a little bit more for those at the moment things. Facebook and also with YouTube. So just 5x5 News and you'll find me there, or just by my name, Mike Turber.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Once again, thank you so much for the time. Please do hold the line while we close things out with the audience real quick. While you are online checking out everything from 5x5 News, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the videos from our guests like Mike Turber on curiousrealm.com/videos. And of course, the store is where you can find all kinds of great materials from our guests. That's where you can find binaural beat music, therapy music. That is also where you can find your copy of the official Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator in the world of the paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP, and outdoing investigations, this is your pocket log to gather your data as it happens in the field and prepare it in a scientific way to shake the hands of science come the day that you need to. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open minds, your open hearts. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.